for me, it was a, I guess, a creative outlet. It was, you know, a sense of control, not only of the product and what I wanted to make, but also a certain sense of control of my own destiny.
To make wine, you have to have a lot of passion for making wine. It has to matter to you. Otherwise, it can't just be a job. It's too hard. It's too time intensive.
And you can add to that, it's hard, it's time consuming, it doesn't pay well.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't.
This is One on One, a Table for Two production. I am Antoine Aboussamra.
There was no such thing as the internet. There was not a lot of literature beyond just a couple of major textbooks that were written in the 1950s. And there was not a culture of winemaking and wine improvement. So we were on our own.
Every week, One on One dives into the world of food and wine through the eyes and experience of my guests. In each episode, you will discover their journey, what matters to them, the challenge they have faced, and how the world of food and wine is evolving.
I don't think anyone could quite do what we did, how we did it. Because we started with, a few French oak barrels in a borrowed back room.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure to be back for a new episode of the One on One podcast. And for today, it's a wonderful privilege, honor, and pleasure to welcome Megan Huth and Rob Griffin from Barner Griffin. And this is the first time, actually, we're going to Washington State, this wild and wonderful place where everybody talks about their wonderful wines. And today it's kind of also special because we're going into the 40th anniversary of Barner Griffin. So it's one of the oldest winery in Washington State. So it's a great pleasure to talk to the first and the second generation of the winemakers of this wonderful winery. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
When we were preparing for our conversation, you were mentioning that 40 years ago, 45 years ago, so in the 70s and the 80s, Washington State was not the place for winemaking. What drew you to go to this place?
You know, I have to tell a story on myself. My original inspiration about Washington was looking at a bottle of wine from really the only winery in the state of Washington with any awareness and distribution. And on their back label, they had a map of France and a map of Washington and the 47th parallel running right through Bordeaux and right through our area. So there is this strong analogy of a more European-like climate. And that really talked to me. I did not extend this to Ulaanbaatar.
Because it's kind of colder over there.
Yes, and an analogy only works when it works. But it was inspiring to me and got me interested in the concept. And I was a student at the University of California at the time in winemaking. And I remember my major professor advisor, who was a wonderful man, when I explained my excitement about this region, he said, "Oh, don't do that. Their crops are going to die 1 in 5 years because it's too cold. You know, don't extend yourself." But you know, being young and foolish, I ignored his advice and came up anyway.
But I thought that professors at university were usually, you know, helping and say, "Why don't you try? Go for it." You know, encouraging, adventurous ideas.
Well, in this particular case,
it wasn't.
Not so much. And, he wasn't making this up. Historically, the winters up here had been pretty awful. But that was also looking at growing grapes the California way versus what we learned over time in terms of preparing the vines for severe weather. Yeah. So, anyway, I came up here in 1977. Right. There were perhaps 10 or fewer than 10 wineries, and I was the winemaker in charge of the second largest winery in the state, which by any international standards was tiny, but it was an opportunity for me to take a lot of responsibility in an area that I thought was very intriguing. I wasn't at all sure I would stay here, but I thought it would be great experience.
When you got there the first time and you looked at the scenery, you looked at the place and you said, did you say, oh my God, what did I get myself into? Or whatever, some kind of excitement? Or how did you feel? How was the first, you know, reaction?
I came up for an interview in an epic windstorm. So I spent 2 days in this area and saw virtually nothing but dust.
Oh, that's,
and,
welcome.
And yet, you know, I did see some vineyards. I did taste some wines. And my mind was kind of made up that I was going to try it. But if I had used any kind of conventional good judgment, I wouldn't have come. So, and then, you know, I actually moved here, a month later. And
oh,
the
was
weather
great.
Was considerably nicer. So.
Oh, okay. So you started over there. And how difficult were the beginnings? Because you get to that place, you were saying 10 wineries. It's not as if it's the you know, the most, you know, cutting edge winemaking region in the US, and you're full of energy and hope. What happened next?
Bell bottoms, don't forget.
Well, oh yeah, it was an entirely different era, 1977. But I think some of the bigger concerns is that if you could look at the average wine grape grower, and there were very few of them, this would likely be someone who had already been growing grapes, the so-called Concord grape, juice mm-hmm. grapes, they're Vitis labrusca. And
they're from
these
the
are
East Coast, no?
Yes, from the central eastern mm-hmm. part of the country and brought out here. It's a wonderful climate for that fruit, too. But to grow Concord effectively here, you need a lot of water. You need a lot of fertilizer. You need virtually no disease control inputs because mm-hmm. these are naturally disease-resistant vines. Anyway, you water them to death, you fertilize them to death, and this is how people were growing wine grapes. Oh. It's appalling. When I look back at what vineyards used to look like, they were dark tunnels of enormous amounts of foliage. And the fruit tended to be extremely what we call vegetative or vegetal. And it's been a campaign of many people over many years to improve the quality of grape yeah. growing to the point now where I think we have some of the best climate adjusted viticulture in the world here. We really know how to treat our vines, but on the average case then, no one had a clue. So that was a challenge, just getting fruit ripe enough to make wine out of. Then, of course, there's the issue of technology and equipment, and that was pretty minimal, especially in the region. Wineries all over America then were converting to better types of technology. The use of wood barrels was still not universal, mm-hmm. but it tended to be overdone where it was done, so that there's either too much wood in wine or not enough in terms of the ageability issues. And when I look at Washington in those days, the conventional wisdom was it was a climate for white wines. We could make wonderful Riesling, we could make acceptable Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc was a variety with great potential. But reds were a kind of a weak sister, and the way they were being grown, there was a reason for that. And over time, that whole situation has shifted. And now if our region is known for anything, it's Cabernet Sauvignon and other Bordeaux varieties.
Yeah. Back then, did you feel that there was such a margin of progression, things that you could develop? Did you see it back then, or it was like, okay, this is what we have now, let's try something, and then, you know, we'll see what brings us.
As a winemaking technician, my challenge was to convert the fruit I was given into acceptable wine. I made an effort to have impact in the vineyard, but that was not my specialty. So I kind of had to stick to my last, as it were, and convert fruit, sometimes slightly marginal fruit, into excellent wine and had some success doing it. I worked with techniques like acid reduction, which no one does anymore, but the biggest challenges we faced were making, you know, deeply concentrated, colorful red wines out of fruit that was quite possibly heavily overcropped and not grown to a high standard. Yeah. But all of that has changed over time. And then the other thing I always like to point out, especially to younger winemakers, is when I got to the state of Washington, there was one other individual who had a university background, even a college background in the subject. We had a very good researcher at Washington State University in the town of Pullman, which is nearly 3 hours away by car, fortunately closer by telephone. But there was no such thing as the internet. There was not a lot of literature beyond just a couple of major textbooks that were written in the 1950s. And there was not a culture of winemaking and wine improvement. So we were on our own. And sometimes it was very, very nervous making. We really didn't know what to do at times. We found our way through. And I look back at some of my early efforts with horror, not the wines, but the production techniques I used. And I did that primarily because that was what I had to do.
So Megan is, for those, because it's a podcast, you can't see it, but then Megan is looking at you with big eyes. And I was wondering, as a second generation, when you hear the stories of back in the 70s and things like that, how does it make you feel?
I think the stories are so interesting, right? And there's this history of this area that's now quite large and quite recognized. And my dad is the one that, you know, was making those stories, was creating that narrative, and helping the whole state become what it is. And I just think it's so fun. And then also there's a lot to learn. And I think about it sometimes because now I am older than he was when he moved up here from his very safe California wine industry job. And I don't know if I would ever do that. Would I ever go somewhere without any support or, you know, an industry that was already built? Like, that just takes such either, you know, insight and like belief in yourself, or complete unawareness, or one of the two, you know.
You think today it's a bit more, you know, people play safe more?
There are other people making wine here. It's it's not a handful. It's, or if it is, it's at least a bigger handful. You know, I could get 10 people on the phone that all have a college degree in winemaking and ask the same question and at least develop some sort of round answer. Whereas, you know, in Rob's day, it was sort of like, all right, well, this person used to farm this crop. Let's see if they can help narrow in what would make a really good grape for wine.
You think that that kind of exploration that they used to have is something a bit missing today, because it's a bit more, you know, it's a bit more set up and, you know, a lot of experience have gone through? Or you still find that way of exploring new things and developing new things and being curious?
I think that winemakers have to stay curious. We still run trials in the winery. I think that's part of the adventure. That's part of making the perfect glass of wine, the perfect bottle of wine, is that constant state of exploring. So that part of it is still there, and obviously that was how I grew up and that's my heart too. But I'm not trying to do something that was completely undone before.
So Rob, to go back to the old story, so you worked with wineries, then you decide to start your own winery, 1983. Why did you want to do that?
You know, I think it's any winemaker's dream to have complete and utter control over what they make, the grapes they start with, the techniques they use. And I can say with some honesty that the commercial side, the business side, was an afterthought. when I look at my time at the University of California, I could have been taking business courses when I was taking music appreciation and literature courses and that kind of thing that I found very interesting, but they're stimulating. But boy, I could have used some simple business acumen that I didn't have. But all of that being said, it was the winemaking that fascinated me, that drove me forward. And over time, we've been fortunate to have people on staff or colleagues who get excited about the other side of the equation, selling the product, which has never been my strong point.
If I'm just like a slight comment, you know, business studies is a bit overrated. if you are able to transform grapes into wonderful wine, you can be a great businessman. I think you get everything, but that was just a small aside to that.
that's how it's worked, luckily.
Yeah, I appreciate that insight, because that's sort of our story in a sense. I think what my wife and I and the family has done over time was kind of a product of its time. I don't think anyone could quite do what we did, how we did it, because we started with a few French oak barrels and a borrowed back room in a winery where I did some technical consulting, and we really had no financial backing at all. Mm-hmm. Yet, you know, from the very first year when we made all of 300 cases of wine, we were profitable. Had we not been profitable, there wouldn't have been a second year. So
because you knew you had to sell, because if you were if you didn't sell, you wouldn't be able to go forward.
We did, and there was an excitement and thirst in our major market, which has always been the Western Washington, Seattle area. Mm-hmm. There was excitement and acceptance of an upstart brand. And I had some presence from the fact that I had been in the state making wine for a number of years at that point. But now, with literally 1,000 winemakers, that degree of excitement has softened a little bit. There's less immediate acceptability, and that impacts the ability of the small to grow and get bigger to a point of profitability.
Yeah, when you produce your first vintage for Barnard Griffin, the question is in two parts. Did you know what you were going to produce? And when you tasted it, what was your reaction?
Well, I have to speak honestly. I started basically with borrowed grapes from a grower who's also been a very close friend over the years. And I won't say we were experimental, but our technology was rather low. And, I won't even talk about where we fermented this stuff, because it might not have been legal, but, you know, we got a very simple start, but I saw promise in what we were doing. Certainly the wines were, I thought, interesting, and we were using a technique of barrel fermentation, which is universal at this point, but at that time not as widely practiced. I remember the major professor of the whole program at the University of California referring to fermenting Chardonnay in a barrel as, quote, a filthy practice, and referred to induced malolactic fermentation as spoilage and anathema. all the things that we take for granted as quality enhancements were preached against, and perhaps for a reason, but the circumstances have changed.
Yes, but you sold 300 cases the first year, the first vintage. It means that
we did.
People enjoyed the wine, and that's what else can you expect at the end of the day? That's the best testimony that your work is being appreciated.
Right, and while this was happening, I was also working for another winery within the industry, and the owners there were quite liberal in allowing me to do what I did, even helpful to the extent that I was allowed to rent equipment and so on and so forth, all of this offset by a probably meager salary, but I was not concerned about that. I was concerned about being able to create our own brand. So it worked very well for everyone at that time.
If I have to make a parallel, it sounds like an artist. The artist is concerned with creating the art to making the best art possible they can do. And if people accept it, you know, if the audience accept it, if the listeners accept it, if the viewers accept it, then fine. And the byproduct is going to be success somehow and making money and living out of this. But the concern at the beginning is not what would people think about it, but really the process itself.
Right. And, you know, for me, it was, a creative outlet. It was, you know, a sense of control, not only of the product and what I wanted to make, but also a certain sense of control of my own destiny. So it was very exciting to start this small brand. Fortunately, my wife had a good career in the healthcare industry at the time. So that was helpful.
And it's really neat now because we get to hear those stories of like, oh, I had this wine, you know, at my college graduation, or, you know, I proposed to my, you know, partner with this wine. And so now it's like being that deep rooted in Washington, it's like we get all these really cool stories of how this wine has been with people for most of their drinking careers. Yes. Now.
So Megan, why did you join the family winery? Because you could have done anything.
Yeah, I was always told that I could do anything and that it wasn't expected that I would come to wine. But I kind of have this, you know, probably over-romantic idea that wine chooses who gets to be part of it. And
why is that? Why is that romantic?
It's just, you know, this idea that you know, wine chose me to be part of its life when I was born. I was in it. You know, I grew up and was 3 or 4 and putting stickers on wine bottles. I was taking dinner to my dad at late nights at harvest, watching the press spin around. I was walking through vineyard blocks, you know, at 8 with my sister, probably eating way too many and exploring that world. And obviously later, I learned that this is what I wanted to do. And to make wine, you have to have a lot of passion for making wine. It has to matter to you. Otherwise, it can't just be a job. It's too hard. It's too time intensive. And so you have to share that same passion.
And you can add to that, it's hard, it's time consuming, and it doesn't pay well.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't. You're constantly sticky. And yet, it's amazing. And I have so much gratitude for being able to make wine and then get to share the story of our family's legacy.
That's a common theme with all the winemakers I've spoken to from all across the world. That's the thing that joins them all. It's not the money. There's something different. The relationship to the terroir, to the land, to the earth, to the grapes, the process, making exactly. People happy. It's wonderful. I'm almost jealous.
made by more than one generation for more than one generation.
That's a kind of an older concept in this day and age, that wineries are discrete places with families who are there for generations and so on and so forth. So much of what you see in the wine business, at least in this country now, is a flash in the pan commercial effort without any roots. And we've always hoped that we could create something that would sustain, you know, some degree of future generations and create something of a degree of permanence.
Megan, what do you feel pressure a little bit to take on, you know, to work in a winery and know that you're going to have to pass this on as well? How do you see your role as a second generation?
Yeah, there is a lot of pressure as a second generation, but with that also a lot of opportunity. And so I'm able to get this, you know, 40 plus years of insight. Mm-hmm. And when I have ideas, you know, they're listened to, but also kind of that vantage point of the business, well, at least, you know, the goal is that the business will continue to grow and then with that sustain more than one family, and kind of capture that essence of this like legacy, you know, multi-generation, all of that. So one day at a time. A lot of times you hear the second generations ruin businesses and third generations are the one that grow them back up into like sustaining legacy brands. So I'm going to try to not screw it up, basically.
Okay. So as you're talking, how, and then I'm going to ask the question to your father, how difficult is it to work with your father?
That would entirely depend on the day. But okay. No, most days it's great. And it's a big enough place that if we need some space, independent work time. And also we're trying to get Rob out of the day-to-day stuff. You know, yeah. He doesn't need to be rifling through paperwork. He wants to be tasting wine and seeing what progress can be made, I guess.
Very diplomatic answer. Rob, how does it feel to work with your daughter?
I have to remind myself sometimes that my daughter's not at fifth grade, and I find myself explaining something that does not need to be explained, and she's pretty good at letting me know when I'm doing that, but nonetheless, one has to change one's outlook and perspective, and indeed, both my wife and I are looking forward to the day when we can step away a little more than we have up to this point.
When you produce the wines, how do you decide on the taste profile? Is it a discussion between the two of you? Because maybe you have, you know, different way of you know, likings and different way of tastings. And how do you decide who gets the upper hand, or is it a joint work in terms of?
It's definitely collaborative. Everything? Yeah, it's collaborative effort. Although a lot of times it will default to who has a stronger, like, oh, I really love what this one's doing and let me tell you why and see if you get that. But then we try wines that are built to have a more ageability, or be drank in several years. And for that, you know, we do give Rob a stronger vote, because he's obviously seen more turnover in aged red wines. But I think you listen to me sometimes, or call for like another tasting. There was an example just last week where I was very sure that one blend was better than the other. And he basically said, well, prove it. And so we set up a triangle tasting where you had to call out the wine. You had to A, call out the wine that was different, and B, like it better. And so we kind of test ourselves that way too.
Did you win?
No, rarely.
Actually, I won that one, but, which is normal.
Yeah, yes, sure.
Right. Yeah. I would say, you know, to answer your original question, stylistically, we have always tried to make wines that are a direct expression of Washington, kind of written large. Mm-hmm. In the intervening years between the time I started and now, there has been a lot of identification of subregions, and you know, my patch is better than your patch kind of mentality. I have always seen, you know, the best wine I can make to get to customers at the best price is going to be from multiple origins, and I can take the virtues of one site, which is also going to have some deficiencies, and combine that with the virtues of another site and overcome its deficiencies, mm-hmm. and blend a better wine than either one would be by themselves. So that being said, we're trying to make wines of varietal purity, and yet with clean, direct flavors, but as much elegance as we can manage in the process, yeah. If that makes any sense.
It does. Unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of the conversation, and we'll finish with the Pivot questionnaire. But before that, I have two questions. The first one is, how much of a pressure is what consumers are looking for? You know, there's natural wines, a lot of trends happening. How much pressure is there to kind of direct the style of wine that you're creating towards them, or you're sticking to, you know, the taste profile and what, you know, Barnard Griffin has been about? How does it work?
I think we've learned that we have to stay true to our original course. You know, just a short example. One of our most successful wines in terms of volume is a dry rosé of Sangiovese.
Mm-hmm.
And we were making dry rosé before it became enormously popular in our country. And one of the aspects of the wine is it has a beautiful electric pink color, even though it's quite dry. And we got pressure from the markets that, you know, the Provençal rosés were so popular, mm-hmm. and they're virtually white. And why is yours so dark? It's costing us sales and so forth. And we looked at responding to that, but that would not have been true to the grape. So even though we may have tried to back away on the color situation, we ultimately didn't. And now we're developing some praise in the industry. Well, thank God your wine has some color. Thank God it has flavor, you know, this kind of thing. So the wheel is always turning, and I've been around long enough to see multiple turns of fashion in terms of, you know, what kind of flavor profiles are popular. We need to be steady in what we do rather than trying to react to trends, because we will always be behind a trend unless we made it. So
yes, and it looks like that you're ahead of the curve a few times.
A few times, a few lucky times.
Yes. A few lucky times. Now, we're in the 40th anniversary year. I'll start with Megan. How do you see the next 40 years?
Oh my gosh, what a good question. With a lot of hope and good glasses of wine and community building.
Okay. Nice. Rob?
And, you know, I think we're going to see, you know, looking at all the changes going on in the world, we will have to change some of what we do. You know, climactically, I think we're in a good place to weather some of the environmental storms, but we also need to just do some basic stuff. We need a more efficient, intelligent way of packaging our wine and getting them to our consumers without compromising the quality. I mean, glass bottles are wonderful, but they're terribly taxing on the environment. So what are we going to do? I have no idea, but those are issues that have to be addressed in the next 40 years.
I think we'll also see more land go in to development for wine. And that's probably Barnard Griffin's approach too, is to go back into holding some vineyard sites and allow that control aspect. But, you know, 40 plus years working in the industry, Rob knows where a lot of the growers are and the grapes that come off each site in the state.
Yeah, although honestly, some of those sites are getting old.
Yeah.
You need to be out finding new sites and new growers.
Yes. Well, I can only wish you, and I'm sure you're going to have loads of success, continuous success for the next 40 years and beyond. Because
well, thank you so much.
When you can feel the attachment to the land completely, and this is wonderful. This is really, really wonderful. And so your wines are available in Washington State. Do you export to other places? Do you sell to other places in the U.S. or beyond?
We do a bit in Canada, mm-hmm. and the occasional, almost episodic thing in the Far East. But we still have ground to cover within the United States in terms of coverage. So we have our strongest effort here within the United States.
Okay. Well, we wish you all the best on that. As I said, we're getting very close now to the end of the conversation. But before that, we'll finish as usual with the people questionnaire. So it's the first thing that comes to your mind. So I'll ask the question and we can say Rob starts, Megan continues, or whomever wants to go first. Are you ready?
Yes.
Sure.
What's your favorite word?
Cavatappi.
Adventure.
Okay. What's your least favorite word?
Recipient. difficult word to get out. Sisyphean, as in a task for Sisyphus, you know. Yeah.
Okay.
Sisyphean.
I'm going to say fair.
Okay. Easier to pronounce.
Way easier to pronounce.
Your favorite virtue?
Gratitude.
I would say perseverance.
Your favorite quality in a man?
Strength.
I would say perseverance.
Favorite quality in a woman?
Bravery.
Strength.
I was expecting perseverance. What wine would you use to describe yourself?
Oh, gosh. I would say Cote de Rhone.
I'm going to say Syrah.
Okay. What aroma or smell do you love?
Nutmeg.
Petrichor.
Petrichor?
The smell right after it rains in like the desert.
Oh, nice. So this is not beeped, so you can just say whatever you feel like. What's your favorite curse word?
Bullshit.
God damn it.
What sound or noise do you love?
I like the deep sound of a French horn.
Oh, nice. I like the sound of my toddler laughing.
Oh, what sound or noise do you hate?
Someone eating potato chips.
Same. Exact same.
What plant or animal would you like to be reincarnated in?
Would say a giant sequoia redwood tree.
Oh, nice.
That's a good one. I'll say tree as well.
Which one?
A neighboring tree, so we can be buddies for life.
And last question. If heaven exists, what would you hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Oh, you again?
Now we rest.
Okay. Rob Griffin, Megan Youth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Antoine.